Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Roger Hearing, and on this edition, Australia becomes the first country in the world to ban social media for the under-16s. But will it work?
When you've got something like the internet, where it's pretty easy to navigate our way and to subvert the realms of how it's controlled, the challenge is, how do you enforce this?
Also, should stock exchanges move to 24-hour operation?
It's answering the question of can we before you're answering the question of should we, right? We could drive a car 200 miles an hour on the highway, or I suppose, but it doesn't mean that that's necessarily the safest way for everyone to get around.
And Greenland opens up to the world with a new international airport. And you can contact us about anything you hear on WhatsApp. You can send us a voice note too. 0044 330 678 3033. That's 0044 330 678 3033. We'd like to know what you think. Now, Australia has decided to ban social media for the under-16s. It's the first country in the world to do this, and the law won't come into effect for a year. It's going to cover platforms like X, TikTok, Facebook and Instagram, but not messaging services or online gaming. The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, said the legislation was needed to protect young people from the harms of social media. The ban could see tech companies fine millions of dollars if they don't comply. Critics argue it's unclear how it's going to work, and some young people are saying the government doesn't understand the role that social media plays in their lives. Ini Lam is a 16-year-old social media user who lives in Sydney and says despite the dangers, social media is already an intrinsic part of the lives of Australian under-16s.
We all know that social media isn't good for us, but it is hard to get off of it because, like, social media is such a prevalent part in young people's lives and how people socialise and interact with each other and keep in contact and build relationships with each other.
Well, joining me now is Peter Malinauskas, who's Premier of South Australia and one of the country's key politicians backing this bill. Peter, welcome and thank you for being with us here on World Business Report. Let me kick off, if I may, by just asking you, if you think this will make a difference to the lives of young Australians.
Unequivocally, Roger, this is the right thing to do by thousands, if not millions, of young Australians who I know currently are being done harm by the industrialisation, the monetisation of addictive algorithms by social media platforms. And we don't think it will solve every problem, but we think it will absolutely make a positive difference for their mental health and them developing constructive social skills on how to engage with one another.
Well, Peter, stay on the line if you would, because I'm just going to play you something we recorded earlier on with someone who knows a little bit about the way these things work on the inside. He's called Bruce Daisley. He's an author and technology leader. He was also vice president of what was then called Twitter, now X, of course, in Europe and Africa. Now, when I spoke to him earlier, he told me how he thought social media companies would respond to this.
The critical thing is how you actually get those people off the platform. And critically, the only way to do it is to authenticate every adult who's out there. Effectively, the only way you get rid of the people who aren't adults is by proving the people who are. And that's quite an onerous task. In the UK, this is estimated to a population of 80 million people. It's estimated that 5 to 7 million adults don't have ID. And so if you extrapolate that for populations around the world, you know, there's a reasonable percentage of people who just don't have the ability to prove their age. And with that comes complexity, and with that comes unexpected consequences, I think.
And also, I suppose, it's the way of keeping it in that particular area, that jurisdiction. I mean, Australia is quite a long way from anywhere else, but the point is that you, once you start the principle, perhaps, or even the technology operating, they've pretty much got to do it everywhere, haven't they?
I think you raise a really interesting point. In the US, a number of states have tried to introduce TikTok bans and bans on adult content. And in fact, the quickest thing it did was teach young children how to download virtual private networks, VPNs. And so effectively, the reason why those bans didn't work is because effectively every child became the agent of teaching each other how to get around those bans. And that's the challenge. When you've got something like the internet, where it's pretty easy to navigate our way and to subvert the realms of how it's controlled. The challenge is, how do you enforce this? Whereas, you know, in Australia, very quickly, anyone could use a VPN to say they're in New Zealand, and all of a sudden their problems go away.
So if you were in a position of authority at Twitter, now X, of course, now, or one of the other networks, would you be advising the company to just get the technology working, find a way around it, say, look, you know, you're ingenious enough to develop all this in the first place, you can find a way to get proper ID? Or are you just going to say, well, there's nothing we can do, we'll just have to go through something, but in the end, it's not a possible thing to solve?
I think that the notion that anyone can get the technology to do this, unfortunately, is a flight of fantasy. There's no simple fix to this. And in fact, the reason why you can read that there's no simple fix is you often hear legislators saying, oh, we're going to introduce facial age estimation. And the way that that would work is that all of a sudden the app would say, please put your face here. We'll scan to see if you're old enough. Well, anyone who's seen a child ask a brother or sister to go into a supermarket to buy them drink will know that that isn't the most reliable technique of trying to prove beyond doubt that someone's age is what they claim to be. I'm not sure social media platforms are necessarily where the bad stuff on the internet is housed. When you ask young people what the worst thing they've seen online is, and frequently they tell us horrible things about pornography or beheadings, these things are not on Instagram. These things are not on TikTok.
Bruce Daisley there. Now, Peter, you're still with us there, Premier of South Australia with us. Peter, I'm just on that. I mean, he described doing something that actually checks people's age on these things and making sure kids can't get around it as a flight of fancy. What do you say?
Look, I don't think there's any doubt about the fact that it is a difficult undertaking, but there's a few things I would say. The first is this. The obligation under the legislation that has now passed the federal parliament is on the social media service providers themselves. Now, let's not understate the fact that these are some of the most technologically and well-capitalised businesses that have ever existed in human history. So if these people have the capability to know everything about us, but apparently not our age, that strikes me as a bit of a stretch. We have it within our capacity to be able to put the obligation on them to develop the means to ensure that young people aren't unreasonably getting access to the platform. The second element is this, and this is the critical argument we continuously hear, is that, oh, well, children will find a way around it. Almost certainly that is true. But that is true for a whole range of products and services that we regulate the access of young children towards. Let's take alcohol, for instance, where globally, you know, we have an age limit on access to booze. Normally it kicks in at 18 years old. Do kids under the age of 18 drink alcohol? Of course they do. The example was given by your previous interviewee. They get their brother or sister to buy it for them. Sure, it happens, but we also know it happens a lot less because legislatures, leaders in our community say this is a basic standard and we expect people to comply with it. And more than that, the most powerful, of course, in that regard are parents themselves. And what this law does, it provides parents the ability to be able to withstand the pressure from their children and their peers to say, look, there is a law in place here. The law says you shouldn't have a social media account. You're not getting access to it.
But
will people get around it? Sure.
Yeah, but Peter, what'll happen and what Bruce was saying to me is actually these companies won't engage in terms of trying to heal what is on these platforms. They'll be too busy trying to sort out who gets onto them. They won't actually deal with the problems of bullying and stuff that happens whatever age people are on there, but happens with children.
Okay, well, a couple of things I'll say to that. TikTok have already proactively kicked off 77 million children around the world from their accounts. And when I say children, I'm talking about children under the age of 13. So TikTok, because they see where the wind is blowing on this, TikTok have a policy that says they can't give an account. This is their own policy for children under the age of 13. They've worked out proactively themselves that they're at 77 million people using TikTok under the age of 13 that shouldn't be. Yeah. And that includes 1 million Australians. So they've already demonstrated they've got the capacity to do this. But more than that, you know, Facebook's been around now since, 2008-ish. They haven't addressed the issue of online bullying up until this point. I don't think they're about to, but it's more than just online bullying. It's the way that social media has inserted itself as being ubiquitous. It's the way it's inserted itself as being the singular tool for the way that young people engage with one another. And we don't believe that's healthy, and that warrants a response.
Well, it'll be very interesting to see what the effect of this is. Peter, perhaps we can talk to you again in a year's time when it comes in and see what the actual effect is. But it's really good to talk to you. Thank you so much for being with us here on World Business Report. That's Peter.
My pleasure.
Melanauskas, Premier of South Australia. Now, one of the things under-16s in Australia won't be able to do then next year is buy things on TikTok, because it's increasingly being used as a shopping place for many young people, where they get encouraged in their purchases by influencers. And of course, Black Friday is almost with us, the annual jamboree of shopping in the US that follows their Thanksgiving festival. So will we see the new era of Gen Z TikTok influencer purchasing in all this? I'm joined now by Finn Witcherly, he's a social media marketing consultant. Finn, thanks for being with us. How often is TikTok used as a platform for sales in this kind of way?
I mean, it's absolutely massive. I mean, all of those TikTok shopping was only introduced as a place within TikTok to be able to purchase. You know, so traditionally people would see something that they would be interested in purchasing, and then they would head off to the link on the website or to the third-party vendor. In 2023, TikTok brought in its own shop, and from then it's going practically toe-to-toe with third-party vendors, with people preferring to stay within TikTok and make the purchases inside of the TikTok shop. So it's absolutely huge. Their ambition is to go toe-to-toe with Amazon and become the number one shopping mall for the Gen Z population. And they're certainly making inroads in that space.
Yeah, it's interesting. Now, is it because of influencers, which I was talking about, where they, you know, this is where you see someone you like and appreciate pushing you towards buying something? Is that what they have, which obviously Amazon doesn't in quite the same way?
Yeah, absolutely, because everybody loves to go shopping, but they hate to be sold to. But the way that influencers operate is like, if you're a fan of a particular footballer or celebrity or pop star or even, you know, somebody who's a big lawyer, for example, you'll listen to them talking about this particular product they can't do without. It might be a light or a mic or some beauty products. And you're like, okay, well, if it works for them and they're really successful, I think I'm going to go ahead and actually purchase. So the stats are very strong on the influence of people actually seeing a product being shown by an influencer. And an influencer could be anybody like you and me who's got a bit of a platform behind them. You don't have to have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of fans. You just have to have a loyal community who trusts you. And then they decide that they want to buy based on your recommendations. It's just like you and me saying, oh, we loved going to see that particular film. Go and see it.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting when you put it like that, because it sounds a bit naive, doesn't it, really? You know, influencers are notoriously, potentially, I guess, being paid in the background for what they're doing. And it's a way of directing Gen Z. But Gen Z is supposed to be so literate on this that they will see through that.
Well, there's about 50% of people who know that it's an ad. They know that the influencer is being paid. And obviously, the criteria is that you have to make sure that you're accrediting the fact that you've been paid to promote this particular product. And that's the kind of rules of every single social media platform for every influencer. However, sometimes they're a bit dodgy about how they actually adhere to those policies. But obviously, people could chase them up to make sure that they're doing it properly. But ultimately, you know, 50% of people are aware of that and they don't particularly like the celebrity endorsements. However, those that do actually make the purchases, and what the brands are finding is that rather than in the early stages, they used to always work with big, powerful superstars. They often tend to nowadays in 2024, 2025, start to work with people with less than 2,000 fans, for example, but who are a lot more engaged, a lot more niche, and you can actually get a lot better results rather than going with the big brands because they tend to be less trustworthy.
Yeah, interesting. There we are. People like me even could be influencers. You never know. Thanks so much for being with us, Finn. Very good to talk to you. Finn Witcherly there. Well, You can contact us on that, I guess, and whatever you fancy as well. A quick reminder, WhatsApp. You can call us +44 330 678 3033 is the way to do it. And a reminder, you're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now, it might surprise you in our 24-hour globalised world that most stock exchanges have fixed hours. They open and they close. Pre-market runs from 4am to 9:30am, regular runs 9:30am to 4pm, and after hours run from 4pm to 8pm New York time. That's what happens in America. But what if it were 24 hours? Well, regulators in New York have now approved plans for the first 24-hour stock exchange, round-the-clock trading. Dmitry Galinov is chief executive and founder of 24 Exchange.
For different people, right now the market is open 24 hours a day. The news are flowing 24 hours a day. And companies like Tesla and Microsoft, they have worldwide following. So essentially, when the investors are awake in Asia, they can trade Tesla and Microsoft during the hours that they awake. And when the investors are awake in US, they'll trade in their hours. So you have around-the-clock access to global investors.
Dmitry Galinov. But Tyler Gelash, chief executive of the investor advocate group Healthy Markets Association, told me what's wrong with this idea.
Well, there are a couple of things. First, it's answering the question of can we before you're answering the question of should we, right? And so just because you can do something from a technological perspective, we could drive a car 200 miles an hour on the highway, or I suppose, but it doesn't mean that that's necessarily the safest way for everyone to get around.
But why do you think it's not safe?
The issue here is there are two different types of people who are impacted. There's the folks who are trading in those markets and the folks who are not, right? So there's a handful of people that are for sure going to want to trade in the late wee hours of the morning. Either they may be abroad from the US, or otherwise they may just be someone who woke up in the middle of the night and decided to enter a trade at 1 a.m. The interesting part is the commission, in the way that they approved this, the regulator approved this, is they did their best to try to protect that person, try to make sure that they would get the best prices available. There aren't a lot of people who are trying to buy and sell, and so getting good prices in the wee hours is not likely to happen. But they said, hey, we'll make them get a little more disclosure to say you're more likely to get ripped off in the middle of the night, but you're free to do it. The problem I have, and the problem I think many big institutional investors and retirement plans and those types of folks have, is how will their prices be impacted? Will they be subject to margin calls and regulatory limits the next day, right? It's already very hard to trade during a million shares during the course of a day in a particular stock or over the course of a week. But it becomes a really big thing when market participants like big pension funds wake up in the morning and they find, hey, this stock price may have moved 5 or 7% overnight or 10% overnight. And now they're subject to a particularly large margin call.
But Tyler, let me put it to you that it's already in effect a 24-hour probation because, as you know, things go on in Hong Kong or in London or all around the world. The entire 24-hour cycle is covered. So what you're saying is true, but then people might wake up and find that's true anyway because of what's happened in other exchanges.
Because of the way the trading is occurring, not on an exchange, not in a public tape, they're not going to be subject to that, like a margin call based on trading that happens overnight today. So when a trader or a compliance person goes to bed at night, they leave their office after doing all the back office operations and clearing and settlement and all of those things that they worry about. When they reconcile the trade at 8 p.m., you know, 3, 4, 5 hours after trading, they know that they're safe the next morning. Now, new news may happen. A company earnings announcement, a war may break out, all sorts of things may happen. But then everybody's wrestling with it at the same time. It's not, hey, I went to bed at 8 p.m. and I woke up with a $100 million margin call the next morning based on very thin trading by retail traders overnight.
Tyler Gelash there. Well, let's talk to someone who is Mr. Wall Street in many ways. Kerry Leahy, Professor of Economics at Columbia University. Back with us here on World Business Report. Kerry, thanks for being with us. Before we talk about what's happening, of course, US markets shut today anyway. How would you feel about 24-hour operation on Wall Street?
I can certainly understand the reason for doing it, to provide some liquidity. But even overnight, as some of your participants have talked about, markets can move rather violently. And it is true that if you have a more institutionalized framework, even though you can trade effectively 24 hours, you have at least in terms of checking on your trades, you have a timeout or a breathing period, which may be very useful. So the difficulty for 24-hour trading, I think, will be precisely on the point of where you have to be on top of your position at every minute of the day, and that will require more workers, better computer systems, and the like. But I don't see any way you're eventually not going to get around it, because so many things are already traded 24 hours, such as exchange rates and bonds. Stocks just can't end up living in their own little universe forever.
Indeed. Well, let's talk about what has been moving, because it's not the US today, of course, closed for the Thanksgiving holiday, but Eurozone stock markets bouncing back a bit because France, a political standoff, does show signs of easing. There was a lot of worry about that yesterday, wasn't there?
Oh, absolutely. You have, the second largest economy in Europe may have a demise of their current government over the problem that virtually every civilized nation faces is you've got a very expensive social support system, and you're not willing to fully fund it. And that leads to problems down the road, because people know the way to make their economy stronger is to cut back on spending and cut back on support. But that's something that makes sense in the long run. In the short run, it's bad for the economy. It's bad for labor. And that's why you had all the problems yesterday.
And we'll see how it all kicks off, or doesn't, I guess, when they are back on tomorrow. And it'll be interesting to see how impact, if it has any, on US markets on the backwash of that. But thanks so much for being with us, Kerry. Kerry Leahy there, Professor of Economics at Columbia University. Now, Greenland is a huge island located next to Canada, but part of the Kingdom of Denmark. It isn't the easiest place to get to, but a new international airport has just opened its runways in Greenland's capital, Nuuk, allowing larger aircraft to land for the first time. It paves the way for direct flights from the United States and from Europe. It's the first of three airport projects that officials hope will boost the local economy by making the Arctic territory more accessible than ever before. Adrienne Murray has been to have a look.
Rock has been blasted and tarmac laid to get this longer runway ready. And the finishing touches have been put to a brand new terminal. Until now, only small propeller planes could land in the country's biggest city. But from Thursday, that will change.
Much larger aircraft will be able to arrive here in Nuuk, and that will pave the way for new connections to Greenland's capital.
Many locals welcome the change.
It is not only an airport for me, it is also an airport for a modern Greenland.
Lately we have been shut from the whole world, and now we're going to open for the world.
Only 4 hours flight from either Europe or East Coast USA, Nuuk will become Greenland's travel hub. Inside an Air Greenland hangar, I spoke to the airline's CEO, Jakob Nitter Sorensen.
It's going to shorten the travel time, and it's going to decrease the cost of producing the flight. So hopefully that will have a positive impact on the ticket prices. That will have a positive impact on demand as well.
From June, SAS will also fly from Copenhagen, and United will launch twice-weekly flights direct from New York. Greenland is a vast territory with a population of just 57,000 people. But until now, a remote runway built by the Americans during World War II has been the main entry point. Travellers then have to transit to their destination in small turboprop planes. And that's often been time-consuming, young Greenlander Isaac Finn tells me.
First have to fly over there, and then you have to wait, and then there's like bad weather or not enough planes, and then you get stuck there. It's annoying.
After Nuuk, two more new airports will open in 2026 as part of a plan to boost the economy. More than $800 million has been spent. Jens Lauritsen is the CEO of Greenland Airports.
It will be the key to opening up Greenland, to make it easy accessible from Europe or North America. Once you make a country that has been quite difficult to get to and you create an easy access like this, I'm sure we will see a lot of tourism, we will see a lot of change.
Greenland is already seeing a small tourism boom, and visitors came in record numbers last year. However, hotel accommodation is still limited.
And this is the first cabin.
The owners at Inuk Hostels have recently invested, adding luxury glass igloos. Marin Louisa Poulsen Christensen is a co-owner and the manager.
We are preparing by making new tours. Many local people got their own boats as well. Of course, we need more accommodation here. We also need more local guides and local workers.
Now, though, it's the public sector and fishing that drives Greenland's economy. Inside a waterfront factory owned by Polar Seafoods, a huge catch of prawns is being steamed, shelled and frozen, ready for export by container ship. The company's chair, Michael Binzer, hopes that shorter direct flights will open up new business possibilities.
I think the biggest change is going to that we look into more fresh seafood. It will cut down the transportation by maybe a full day, which is a lot.
This new infrastructure is meant to be a shot in the arm for Greenland's economy, but its impact could be far-reaching. Naya Nathanielsen is Greenland's business minister.
It's going to be absolutely profound effect on society, not only for the population, but also for the business sector. I also sense that it's going to really change the map of Greenland. That will bring with it a lot of good, but also some changes we will probably need to adjust into.
And this once hard-to-reach Arctic territory is being brought closer to Europe and North America than ever before.
Adrian Murray there at the opening of the new Greenland Airport. And I should tell you, if you're planning on flying in there right now, you should wrap up warm because it's -2, getting towards -6, thick cloud and a gentle breeze, mind you. It's a bit like that in London right now. Certainly, it's very cold. That's it for a World Business Report. Thanks for listening from me and the team. Bye-bye.